When he reflected publicly on Africa, Wolfowitz grouped its countries into three broad categories. About a third of the continent's nation-states seemed to be hopeless basket cases, including Sudan, Somalia, and Zimbabwe. About another third, endowed with oil and other natural resources, were doing better but were struggling with the resource curse. Angola, Equatorial Guinea, and Chad were examples. Another third were becoming successful, registering positive economic growth rates for 10 years or more, Botswana, for example, and also previously failed states such as Mozambique and Rwanda. Wolfowitz felt the World Bank had an opportunity to promote a more nuanced picture of Africa's economy. The continent's negative image wasn't helped by large rock concerts that talk about what a miserable, failing place it is, he remarked. He did not blame Bono or U2 for this image problem. He blamed dictators like Zimbabwe's Robert Mugabe. Chad's ruler was nowhere near as bad as Zimbabwe's, but no good would come from appeasing Dabie on the matter of his arms purchases, Wolfowitz concluded. Chad has a sovereign right to decide how to spend the oil money, Dabie argued to Wolfowitz over the telephone on the night of January 5, 2006. Their conflict had reached a climax. Wolfowitz was threatening to freeze the money ExxonMobil and its partners deposited in Chad's Citigroup accounts in London, an action he could take by invoking the bank's rights under its pipeline lending agreements. Even though the amount the bank had lent to Chad was relatively small, less than the annual oil revenue Dabie now received, under the loan terms, the bank could seize Dabie's funds. Wolfowitz told Dabie that he accepted that Chad was sovereign. However, Chad's sovereign government had entered into certain contractual commitments with the World Bank to spend oil revenue on the health, education, and welfare of Chad's people. It was in the interests of Chad's sovereign government, Wolfowitz argued, to show the world that it was an honorable party to the agreements it had made. They talked through French translators that night for 2 hours. Neither of them budged. The next day, Wolfowitz announced that the World Bank would withhold new loans to Chad. A freeze on its bank account would follow if Dabie refused to compromise. Wolfowitz tipped Dabie into a rage. His aides told Ron Royal at ExxonMobil that if they went along with the World Bank any longer, Chad might order the corporation to shut down all oil production. Royal met with Ambassador Wall at the U.S. Embassy. Closure of Chad's fields would be catastrophic, he said, and would likely set off a chain of loan defaults. ExxonMobil wanted a cooling-off period and had asked the World Bank for time to negotiate a compromise, but the bank had responded with a letter to Irving declining ExxonMobil's request. Royal revealed to Wall for the first time that ExxonMobil was on the verge of profitability in Chad and that, therefore, the corporation was now in an income tax-paying position. Given rising world oil prices, ExxonMobil and its partners might soon hand over to Dabie's regime between $80 million and $200 million in initial tax payments, enough, perhaps, for Chad to pay off the World Bank altogether and extricate itself from its commitments to social investments. Royal met with Dabie in the capital and warned him that dismantling oil operations and forcing the World Bank to leave would jeopardize the reputation of the country and the possibility of foreign investment. He also told Dabie for the first time that Chad would soon receive a tax windfall if the president allowed ExxonMobil to keep pumping oil. Dabie was surprised. He asked for specifics, but remained noncommittal about compromise. Royal contacted Wall at the American Embassy and told him that he feared a meltdown and a final collapse of the entire Chadian oil project, 6 years and several $1 billion of investment so far. Royal proposed various plans by which ExxonMobil might win support from the Bush administration to defy Wolfowitz's hard line. Under Royal's plans, ExxonMobil would pay Dabie royalties while international talks proceeded. The oil company would put some of this cash directly into Chad's treasury, defying and undermining Wolfowitz's freeze. Ambassador Wall took up the case. He met with Dabie and found the Chadian president taken aback by Wolfowitz's decisive actions. Wall understood that the United States had many interests in Chad besides the World Bank's development goals. the economic benefits and jobs associated with oil production, counterterrorism, the care of refugees from Darfur, and the need for Chad's cooperation in bringing the Darfur conflict to an end. The ambassador tried to promote the idea that it would be in the interest of both Dabih and the World Bank to reach a settlement. By now, ExxonMobil had made its choice clear. It was more interested in the survival of Chad's oil production than it was in the World Bank's experiment in nation-building. If Dabih found a way to pay back his bank loans and also stuck to the letter of his oil production contract, ExxonMobil would stay with him, according to State Department cables and ExxonMobil managers involved. The corporation wanted to keep its options open. Esso is seeking to stress its neutral position vis-à-vis the dispute between the World Bank and the government of Chad, as it is not a signatory to the agreement, Wall reported to Washington. ExxonMobil described its general approach to troubled African countries where it produced oil by emphasizing that the corporation was merely a guest. And as a guest, we've got to show respect. It's not up to us to go into a sovereign country and tell them how they ought to be governing their people. That was an Orwellian defense in this case, because the Chad oil project had been made possible for ExxonMobil in the first place, precisely because the corporation had supported the World Bank's plan to control the management of Chad's sovereign funds. Yet by declining to sign the final bank agreement, ExxonMobil had positioned itself so that it was no longer accountable. As the bank's deal with Dabih fell apart, the corporation stood aside. If anything, the corporation was subtly encouraging Dabih to defy Wolfowitz. "We like the format we had," Andre Madec, an ExxonMobil global community relations executive, said of the emerging dispute. But he refused to criticize Dabih for his decision to balk. Robert Zoellick, the Bush administration's deputy secretary of state, telephoned Wolfowitz and talked with him about the violence in Darfur and the gathering rebel attacks on Chad, sponsored by Sudan's notorious intelligence service. Wolfowitz said he felt he could work out a compromise with Dabih. He was wrong. Dabih refused to accept the bank's new proposals, which were designed to maintain social spending but allow some more defense spending.